You know what they say, if it's not broken. How good is Beethoven? The man was a genius. People sometimes say, like, where's the modern Beethovens? Where's the Vivaldis? The Mozarts? I have to say, movie composers are the modern day Beethovens. My wife Anna is an incredible, talented pianist and composer, and she's been introducing me to the intricacies of the beauty of film composition. And man, if you just listen to how Hans Zimmer made the soundtrack to Dune, the guy's out of this world. I believe those guys and girls are going to be the ones that in 100 years people look back and they still listen to that and look at that music. That's the goodies of today. So today we're going to be going inside Brazil's largest favelas. In Brazil, they don't use the word favela. Actually, I've used that word on the title because so that people understand what I'm talking about. But in Brazil, they use the word community or comunidade in Portuguese. And because to the people living there, it's not a favela, it's their community and it's their home. And I think you're going to find from this podcast that those communities are quite different to what you expect. And the cause of their existence is quite different to what you expect. So I made 3 trips to Brazil over the last few years, and I'm going to talk about them, share a bit about what happened, what it was like in the communities, what the people were like, what the dangers were. The first trip, I went to Sao Paulo and Campinas, which is inland in Brazil, like kind of a little bit in the south. The first favela we visited was a really big one near Campinas. And once we got in there, we went to a Brazilian jiu-jitsu gym. There was this incredibly awesome guy, and he was running a jiu-jitsu gym for the teenagers there and teaching them about respect, teaching them about following rules, about discipline, by teaching them martial arts. And Brazilian jiu-jitsu goes deep into the Brazilian culture. It's really common, like a lot of guys and girls do Brazilian jiu-jitsu. It's, for those of you who don't know, it's a grappling sport. It's incredibly challenging and physical. If you ever roll with somebody in jiu-jitsu for even 5 minutes, you're completely gassed. 10 minutes will almost kill you because you're using all of your body, every muscle in your body and all of your strength to wrestle somebody, to submit them. And you're like replicating almost like a life and death wrestling match with someone, minus the striking and all the biting and all that crazy stuff that would go with a real fight. But man, I have to say I fell in love with Brazil even from that first trip. The people are incredibly warm, kind. Just even when I first got to the gym, the way the teenage boys were just like showing me how to do certain chokes in jiu-jitsu and how to do techniques. They were just so gentle and so kind, and they weren't like normal teenage boys, you know, like even though they'd grown up in gangs and around drugs and murders and crazy stuff, they were just super kind, super respectful. And the guy was teaching them also about the Bible and just how to become leaders in the community. And it was incredible to see this guy going into this quite dangerous, or very dangerous actually, place where the police wouldn't even go unless they were in an armored vehicle. They had like special police units that would go in, not the regular police. And there's these missionaries that will go in there and set up these things for the community, like jiu-jitsu, music, dance, schools, and provide a way for the young people in those communities to find a way out, to find an alternative to a gang life. So I have to say that first trip, I was like, man, I'm going to go back. I have to go back. I didn't really understand a lot about Brazil and about the government and the people and what was going on to cause these kinds of situations, but I just knew that I wanted to go back. And luckily two years later, I got to go back. And this time the trip was focused on anti-trafficking, and I went to the north first, to Recife, which is on the coast, on the easternmost point of Brazil. It's kind of sticking out there on the side. And in Recife, we went to a home for young women who've been trafficked. victims of human trafficking and have been rescued from those situations and taken to a rehabilitation home where they were getting counseling, they were getting support, they were getting school, they were getting to play sport, to play games. And it was just so special to go there and to just get to show love to these young women and get to talk with them and hear about where they came from and some of their stories too, because it's very rough existence to grow up in extreme poverty in a favela or a community where there's no protection. Especially many of the girls don't have a father who's there around, and they're just completely vulnerable. And then sometimes even their own family are so poor that they will sell their daughter, even very young daughters under 10 years old, to be trafficked, to be sex trafficked. There was an organization that was running the house. It's called Shores of Grace, and I'm going to put a link on the podcast, so if you ever want to support them, you can. So Shores of Grace, they'd been there about 8 years, and they started just by going out on the streets and connecting with these women who were being exploited and building relationship with them. And with women who are being trafficked, it takes a long time to build trust, because they're not just going to instantly trust that any organization has actually got their best interest in mind. So they spent a lot of time building relationships, and slowly were able to start to set up a base and to start actually rescuing women from the streets, rehabilitating them and getting them into work and into different positions. Some of them have even gone into study law and government, and are going to try to change some of the very laws that facilitated the trafficking that happened to them in the first place. For example, in Brazil, the legal age of consent is 14. And because it's so young, that even girls who are 12 or 13 or younger, it makes this gray area where, oh, she's close to 14, you know, so it's fine, you know. In the police's mind and in these guys' mind, they just say, oh, I didn't know, I thought she was 14. Look, she looks 14, you know. And it's like this slippery slope where when you've got a legal age of consent that's so young, it creates massive issues. And a 14-year-old girl is not, it's just, the law is messed up. And so there's women who are going up into law and into government now to get that changed, and also to get more enforcement for human trafficking to help. And there has been movement in Brazil against trafficking, and the government is becoming more aware. And I believe it's a lot to do with these women who have been rescued from the streets and have become educated and are now moving into the government to get these changes made. So it's an absolutely incredible story of transformation. You can get in contact and find more stories of these women if that's something that you want to learn more about. But I was blown away by what was happening, for one, and also by the effect of the people who are going in to help too, that showing that you actually can do something. Poverty and fatherlessness are the two biggest underlying causes of sex trafficking for women and young men and boys too. When a whole community is really poor and desperate, they do desperate things. And when girls are growing up without fathers and broken families, there's no one protecting them. There's no one to keep them safe and to keep the men away from them. So really at the root cause, it's the poverty and it's the broken families that need to be addressed. And it's such a massive question. It's, how do you do that? How do you address poverty? How do you address fatherlessness? And once you identify these two massive causes, I think identifying the cause is the easy part, and going in and solving these issues is the difficult part. And that's when government comes into things. And that's when what I'm going to share about how these communities are formed in the first place is a really important factor in the underlying poverty. In 2016, 369,000 people were estimated to be in modern slavery, according to the Global Slavery Index, in Brazil alone. And the Brazilian Federal Police estimated that between 250,000 and 400,000 children were exploited in 2009 in Brazil. So Brazil's second only to Thailand for child sex trafficking. And there's a massive, massive, massive issue there to be addressed and to be looked at. Towards the end of my second trip, I'd actually gone to a huge rubbish dump called Jardim de Gramacho, where there were thousands of people living in amongst the trash, but they didn't call it trash. They called it material because it was what they would sift through to try to find something to sell or to use to survive. And that just broke my heart to see people living essentially like animals, like in the waste. And it just, the smell was so intense. And to see that people were living in these shacks just amongst the vultures and the sludge and the waste blew me away, that to know that, to actually see and understand. I mean, I'd heard before, but to actually physically see and understand that people are living in those conditions, it changes you forever. There were kids there who had never left the rubbish dump. They'd never been to a shop or a mall. They'd never seen an escalator. They'd never seen the ocean or the beach. And there was this incredible group there that they brought us into the rubbish dump. They're called Iris, Jardim de Gramacho Iris, and I'll put a link to them too. So they've been going into there for years and helping the community there, getting medicine and supporting people and just helping solve community issues that are going on and bringing food and running church services. And those people that are going in there every day and doing that, they're the most incredible people I've ever met in my life. There was even a young woman who, I think she was 18 or 19, and she'd been there since she was 17, and her parents wanted her to go to university and had set things up for her to go to university. And she said, no, I'm giving my life to these kids and to these people living in the rubbish dump. And she's moved there with the other people who are working in there. They live just like right on the outskirts of it, and they drive in. And I could not believe that somebody, especially somebody so young, has just decided to give their life to these people, to these broken people. And it really challenged me to ask the question, like, what am I doing to help and what can I do to help? Before we went in, they said, the guy, Marcus, his name is same as me, he said, look, I just want to tell all you guys that are going in here with us that there has been shootings between the police and the gang here, and there is a risk that you could get shot and you could get killed. Nobody on our team has been killed, but there has been shootings that have happened. And if it happens, you just need to go inside a building and get down as low as you can and get into cover. And he's like, I'm just saying, like, it's probably not going to happen. Nothing's probably going to happen. But I just have to tell you that you need to agree now that you're going to go into this dangerous place, and that it's actually, you know, it's your own decision, and that you're aware that could happen. And everybody in the team was like, yeah, I want to go. And we went in, and while we were doing like a church service with the people, these huge bangs started to go off, like pow, 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 pow. And it was fireworks, not gunshots, it turned out, but actually they use fireworks to signal when the police are coming in, to so that everybody in the community knows that the police are coming, and everybody gets ready and the gangs get armed and get geared up. And then he said, okay, the police are coming and like something could happen. And I said, well, should we get everybody inside? He's like, no, we'll just see if the police vehicle comes down the street, we'll get everybody off the street. And luckily the police did not come down our street. They went somewhere else, so we didn't have any trouble. But it was just like, showed me that, okay, there's real stuff going on here, and it's a different world. It's a constant war between the police and the gangs, that many of the people who live there are just unfortunate collateral damage to those shootings that happen. Some of the locals shared with me some wild stories too. And this is not the norm, so I don't want to put anybody off going to Brazil, because it's such a good place to visit. But I have to share it because it's a crazy story. Firstly, my taxi driver said a few months ago, he was driving down this very highway that he was taking me on, and two motorbikes pulled up next to this car and pulled out guns and pointed them while they were driving 100 kilometers an hour, pointed them into the car and were, you know, trying to make the car pull over so they could rob the car. A police car was driving on the opposite side of the highway. The officer in the passenger seat leaned out of his window, pulled out an assault rifle, and just started shooting across the highway while they were driving one way and the motorbike and the car were driving the other way, shooting with complete disregard to all of the traffic that was in the area, just started shooting at the motorbikers to get them away from this car that they were trying to rob. And the police have been told to have like a short shoot first, ask questions later kind of mentality with gang members and with with people who are trying to rob and assault other people. So the kind of attitude that the government's taking is like a fight fire with fire to crack down on the gangs, but it results in these massive firefights happening out on the streets. And another one, this girl said that she had only actually arrived in Rio. She'd only been there for like a week, and then she was pulling off an off-ramp on the highway, and all of the cars were stopped, and she couldn't get down the off-ramp, and she was thinking, like, she was stuck on the off-ramp, thinking, what's going on? Why can't I go down? There's not usually traffic here. And then she just saw crowds of people running up the off-ramp past all of the cars, all of the doors opening in front of it, people getting out and just running like something off an apocalyptic movie. And then so she got out of her car, and then she saw why. There was a line of gang members holding assault rifles marching up the up-ramp, robbing every single car that they were coming into contact with, and just like robbing everybody, like a mass robbery. And then these police cars pulled up and got into a huge shootout with the gang members. And the girl who was telling me the story, she just ran for her life until things had stopped and the gang members fled the scene, and then she could go back to her car. When I started to hear some of these stories, I was thinking, okay, this is a different world that I'm coming into. There is some like really massive stuff going on here. And I want to repeat, like, as a tourist, your risks are very low in Brazil, because I don't want to put people off going to Brazil by telling these wild stories that happen. Like, these kinds of things happen occasionally. They make for crazy stories, but in general, as a tourist, you're going to have an incredible experience there. I went on that same trip. I'm still talking about the second trip. I went to a community called Rocinha. It's the largest community in Brazil and possibly in the whole of South America. One of the guys, at least, that was taking us in there said there was 500,000 people living there. I also looked it up to see exactly the numbers for you guys, and it's estimated between 100 and 300,000, which just shows how clueless they are to what's actually going on in these communities and how many people are even living there. And to describe it to you, it's this huge valley with rainforest above it, and these houses just built on top of each other all the way up the side of the valley and up the sides of the mountain. And there's these very narrow alleys kind of winding and stairs going all through the community up the valley. And it actually takes quite a long time to wind our way to the top. I think it took about 30 minutes to walk or more to get all the way up. And inside the community was when I first came across the gangs that were armed with guns. And surprisingly, I thought I would be maybe worried or afraid, but I didn't feel any kind of fear. They were quite clearly like not interested in kidnapping or shooting some missionaries that were walking in. They were clearly not interested in harming us, and they could see that we were in there to help the community. We actually had permission from the leaders of the gang to go in there. I think it's a very, very bad idea to go in without having a contact with the gang leaders. With a local Brazilian who has a contact with the gang leaders who can bring you in if you're thinking to do a project or to do anything to help in these communities. There was a tourist just a month after I left who went in there, Spanish tourist, for like a sightseeing tour, and she got shot during a shootout between the police and the gangs. She was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and a bullet went through the car that was kind of touring her around the road going up and past the favela. And that to me, because I found out actually when I came back that happened just after I left there, that to me was just like a bit of a wake-up call that even though sometimes it feels safe when you go in there, things can change like really quickly and it can become really dangerous. So in saying that, like, a lot of the favelas I went to in the south of Brazil were on the safer side, it's still not completely safe, but I didn't feel in any danger, and I didn't feel like that something was going to happen to me. And the people I met in there were incredible, incredible people. And they're just completely normal people, if not even kinder, that live in these communities. But they've just been born, or they've been forced to live in these situations. And I think sometimes we can get some kind of idea in our head that the people living in these circumstances are like somehow going to be different to people living in the West or living somewhere else. But it's crazy how their dreams, their thoughts, their problems, their day-to-day lives actually are so similar to anybody's, and the only thing that they want is to be safe. Like the things they want are the same things that people in not living in poverty want, or in these situations want. They want to be safe, they want their family to be provided for, and they want freedom to do the things they love and to be able to earn money and to live their lives. I think that's quite obvious and kind of goes without saying, but once you go in and you meet the people, you start to click. It starts to click in your mind. Oh, these are the hearts of the people here, and they are just like me. They're just like all of us, and they need change to happen at a higher level. There needs to be a government level change for things to shift in these communities. And that's why this podcast is a lot about leadership and government, because, and that's why I'm talking about this community actually, is because these communities have formed as a result of governmental policies and structures, and also corruption at higher levels, forcing communities to form these isolated living situations where the police aren't welcome. They've got their own militias that run the communities, the drug lords, the gang leaders. And some people, many people actually, choose to go and live in these communities rather than registering themselves as a regular citizen in Brazil, where you pay tax, you pay your water fees, you pay electricity, because the conditions can be so tough. It can be so tough to earn money. It can be so tough to run a business if you do things through the legitimate portals in Brazil. And that was something that the Brazilian people really wanted me to understand. Like every Uber driver said to me, you need to understand, things are hard. I used to be a dentist. One guy told me he used to be a dentist. Another guy, I used to be an engineer, but I can't work because it's so hard to run a business. There's so much red tape stopping me from making money. The taxes are so high, and I don't get anything for the taxes that I'm paying, that I couldn't do it. I had to quit. I had to close my business. The dentist, he said he couldn't afford to pay the rent on his clinic, and he couldn't afford to even just buy a new chair, a dental chair for his clinic. And so he was driving Ubers, and he really wanted me to see. As a tourist, he was like, yeah, you guys, you come to the, you know, he was so used to taking tourists who were just there for fun or for carnival. And he was like, no, it's not just like the nice beach and the acai bowls, even though that those things are incredible. Man, acai is good. But he's like, I really want you to see that this is hard. And then I started to understand, this is why so many people were moving into these favelas or choosing to stay or live in favelas, because even if they had a job, it was better to a better lifestyle to be in there and to be under the protection of the militia than under the protection of the, you know, the government police, because actually in some cases the militia in the favelas and the communities were doing better jobs of keeping you safe, and you were less likely to get robbed or accosted up in these places, that, you know, because you had local protection. Of course, there were the risks between the police and the gang members, but that was the main risk you faced, unless you yourself were selling drugs, and then you got into rivalries with other gang members or other smaller factions within gangs in the favela. If you were just living there as a normal citizen, the main threat would be coming from the conflicts between the gangs and the police, because it seemed to me like the local protection that you got, if you paid you paid your money, and you did everything right and you lived there, it seemed like they actually did a pretty good job in a way of self-governing, in some respects. So I would like to make the case that governments create favelas, not gangsters. And I'm saying that because of the points I made about the high taxes, about corruption, about poor policing that cause these communities to choose their existence, to choose a independent existence from the government. You can think of these communities as little branches off from the main city that have chosen to govern themselves. They even, I couldn't believe this, somehow they've hijacked the electricity from the government mains, and there's just these insanely elaborate bird's nests of wires just going everywhere into these boxes and then distributing everywhere throughout the favela. And it's the most confusing tangle of transistors, and I don't know much about electronics, but there's so much going on that if something breaks, I have no idea who these guys are that can fix the power cuts and deal with electrical problems in these favelas. And you can see why there's fires, because it is carnage. Their power system, you have to go and just see for yourself the absolute bizarreness of how they power their grid in the favelas. It's wild. So on my second trip, I was even more so like, I need to go back again to Brazil. I need to do more, because it wasn't a long trip. And the people I met there were so incredible, so loving, so warm, so hospitable, that and there was so much to be done, so much work that needed to be done there, that I just thought, I just need to go back. I need to go back. So I started learning Portuguese over about a year, and then I went back for my third trip, and this trip was a longer trip. So on my last trip, we went to a few different communities. One of them was called Santa Marta, which is actually where Michael Jackson filmed the Brazil version of They Don't Care About Us, which it's an incredible music video. You should watch it if you get a chance. But that was a really beautiful place, and they had a soccer field like right at the top of the community where we played soccer with the kids and shared with them and hung out with them. And it was beautiful and incredible to be in there. They have this really old rickety like lift or tram, I don't know what you'd call it, like a gondola that's on rails that gets pulled all the way up. And going on that, I tell you, that was quite an experience. I mean, it looked like it could collapse at any second. It was scary, but they've been using it for years, so I figured it's going to be okay. But we took this gondola up to the top, and there's a view of Jesus the Redeemer, the big statue, like right, it's right close to that particular community. And we were there at sunset, so being there was an absolute amazing experience, and getting to connect with the people there was just really special. And the last thing I want to talk about is the youth prison that we visited. So I'm not quite sure what happened, but we somehow got invited to go to a youth prison, and a guy in a bus came and picked us up, and we just jumped on this bus, me and about seven or eight other men and women, and we went there to go and to share with the youth there that were in prison. And we got there, and there was just huge concrete walls with wire on top, and we went inside. We got sort of escorted inside, and we had to put on, it was quite a funny thing, because you weren't supposed to wear shorts, I think. The other guys, they had long pants. I had to put on the prison pants, the orange pants, and I was already wearing, it was a white shirt that was the same. So it ended up, I had the same exact outfit on as the people in the prison. And so, you know, I fit in pretty well. And so I went in there. We went in there, and we went into this classroom, and the guards brought in about 30 teenage boys, and man, it was pretty unreal to see what those boys had been through and the reasons that they were in jail, like, and the scars that covered their body from knife fights. Many of them had big scars down there, like on their arms and on their stomachs and chest from knife wounds. And one boy had a huge scar that went all the way around the front of his throat, where clearly somebody had tried to cut his throat. And seeing that just woke me up to how incredibly violent and terrifying it would be to grow up in these communities, in these favelas, as a young teenage boy getting drawn into gang life. And they're often used as the ones that run the drugs and to do the most dangerous things, the younger boys, because they're sort of the lowest rank in the gang, and they're trying to earn their way into finding a place in the gang and to prove themselves. So they end up doing these crazy things and getting into these crazy fights. And seeing them, and then also starting to understand how similar they are to the other teenage boys that I'd been working with in America and in other places, just that they had just been born into a completely different environment. That was the only difference. They still wanted to just joke around and wanted to be teenage boys, but they'd been forced to try to be men, and to try to not only be men, but to be men living in hell. And they were kind to us. They were so incredible and respectful, and giving us their chairs. Like if there wasn't enough chairs for us, so some of the guys came with their chairs and made us get in their chairs, and so they sat on the floor, and we talked with them and shared with them a message of hope, talk to them about God, talk to them about loving each other, about not fighting, but coming together and learning to be brothers with one another and love one another. And then we sung some songs with them, and many of the boys were just weeping, and we prayed with them, and they even were starting to pray with each other, these boys, and put their arms around each other. And they clearly hadn't been loved in a very long time, if at all, by older guys especially, I think. And just to be shown love and to be shown that there's people that care about them, I think it was really important for them. And that visit to the prison really impacted me in a massive way, just to see the level of need in the youth that are growing up in poverty. And I think for these communities to become safe and to become free from poverty and free from suffering, there would need to be some major changes at a government level, changes that would facilitate easier work environments for the average Brazilian. I think the situation is a real testimony to what can happen if governments put in place conditions which are too difficult for people to thrive and to survive and to make money and to run their businesses. And I think the communities in these favelas are a natural response of societies to a government that are being too harsh and are not giving back fairly to what the people are paying in terms of taxes. And I think it's a real testimony to, you know, what can happen if things go really wrong, and if it becomes a systemic corruption issue and an issue within government, then that's the fruit. So I've talked a lot about some negative things to do with Brazil, but I have to say that if Brazil was somewhere that you were thinking about going, I would highly, highly, highly recommend it. Not just so that you can learn and understand about society there and what's happening, but that you could experience the beauty of the people there and the kindness and the hospitality and the love and the warmness and the openness and the freedom that the people actually have within them there, and the generosity, the incredible generosity I saw when boys from the favela went to busk in the trains doing Michael Jackson impersonations or freestyle rapping or whatever it was. Almost every single person, if not every single Brazilian in the carriage, would give money to them. Even if they didn't have much money themselves, they always gave. They were always generous. And that blew me away to see these people who didn't have a lot just giving to each other so openly. And I can't even imagine how incredible Brazil's potential is, knowing that the people who live there are so good and they're just living in a hard government situation. Imagine if they had a really good government come in that made these changes. And I know these things take time, but Brazil's potential is incredible. It's already an amazing place. And I can see that with the right government, the right policies, the people there would just thrive to an absolute another level. The beaches are incredibly beautiful. The sunsets, the landscapes, acai bowls, the food, the dancing. I highly, highly recommend going to Brazil. If you're going to Brazil for a holiday, for a visit, it is an incredible place and you absolutely have to go. It changed my life on so many levels. So we've got links to Shores of Grace, which is the anti-trafficking group that I talked about up in Recife. There's a link to Jardim de Gramacho, the iris base in the rubbish dump, which you can also support, that are doing absolutely amazing work. I hope you enjoyed this talk about Brazil. I hope you learned something about the communities and the favelas in Brazil. Please review the podcast. It makes a really big difference. And if you want to share it with some of your friends, feel free to do that. See you next time.